I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Wednesday, the 17th of December. In the November 24 issue of The Nation magazine, our guest this hour writes that last year the FBI tallied 461 justifiable homicides committed by law enforcement. Justifiable, he writes, because the Bureau assumes so and the nation's courts have not found otherwise. This is the highest number in two decades, even as the nation's overall homicide rate continues to drop. Homicides committed by on-duty law enforcement make up 3% of the 14,196 homicides committed in the U.S. in 2013. The FBI database found an average of about 96 police homicides a year in which a white officer kills a black person. Chase Madar is joining us this hour of our program to talk about his in-depth article in The Nation magazine. He's a civil rights attorney in New York and is the author of The Passion of Bradley Manning, the story behind the WikiLeaks whistleblower. We'll be welcoming phone calls as we look at a number of issues. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're also on Twitter, and that's at K Dunn Show. Hello, Chase. Thanks very much for being with us.
Delighted to be talking with you this afternoon, Kathleen.
Yeah, we're glad to have you here. It was a very in-depth article looking at so many aspects of this issue. Let's start, if we could, with the number of homicides being the highest in two decades in this country, the number of 461 justifiable homicides, according to law enforcement and to courts. Why is that number so high?
Yeah, that's the real question, because violent crime has gone down precipitously across the board since the early 90s. You would think that police shootings would also be going down. Instead, they are higher than ever. And I think it's clear that that shows that there is a real lack of discipline in many of our police departments, who are a little trigger happy. A little too ready to use lethal force.
You mentioned early in the article, and I'm wondering if this is true of a lot of statutes across the country, Chapter 563 of the Missouri Revised Statutes that gives quite a bit of discretion to officers to wield deadly force. What does that statute say, and is it a statute that other states have as well? Chase? All right, we lost Chase momentarily, so we'll get him back on the air in a moment and talk about Chapter 563 of the Missouri Revised Statutes. I'm wondering if this is something that is in place in many other states in the country. Other parts of his article, as I said, it's really a wide-ranging article. What happens in courtroom practice? Does it prohibit, he believes, any second-guessing of the officer's decision? Is there hindsight permitted? He believes that we need to look at civilian oversight systems in major police departments in the United States and a number of other issues. I don't know. I think we can have you again. Chase, are you there?
Yes, I'm back.
Okay.
Sorry about that.
No, that's okay.
So I caught most of your question.
Okay.
And the fact is, Ferguson, Missouri is not some weird little regional outlier. The law that governed there really governs the rest of the country, also Staten Island. This is a nationwide phenomenon of police shootings and very often apparently unjustified police shootings. It's not just a quirky matter of Missouri's law. This is something that is really enshrined in even our United States Supreme Court jurisprudence, where case law is incredibly deferential to the police. It's really hardwired not just into our politics or institutions, but into the laws themselves. And I hope people realize this, just because there's a tendency among many people, particularly among liberals, I think, to assume that the laws are good, they're just being misapplied, that the laws are good, they're just being abused somehow. That's really not the case here. The laws, all the way up to Supreme Court jurisprudence again, is incredibly deferential to police officers, gives them an incredible amount of built-in leeway when it comes to opening fire or using other forms of lethal force.
You say that the Supreme Court jurisprudence looks at objective reasonableness. What is objective reasonableness?
Yes, that was the standard that was developed in the 1985 Supreme Court case of Tennessee versus Garner, which first appeared to be a real step forward if you're a civil libertarian. It first appeared to tighten restrictions on the police use of deadly force as it did away with the so-called fleeing felon rule, which had allowed police to open fire on any fleeing felon, really regardless. So we have then this objectively reasonable standard. And who could be against that? It's objectively reasonable. It sounds marvelous. It's objectively reasonable. In fact, in actual practice, the way this objectively reasonable standard is applied is all about the subjective impressions of that police officer in the heat of the moment. And the law really prohibits the use of hindsight or really much second guessing at all. And it's, even though it sounds quite rational and reasonable, objectively reasonable really is all about the subjective cop's eye view of the situation, which our laws have deeply internalized.
Do you imagine there will be a time, and considering what's been happening the last few months and the marches in the country and the attention focused on New York and Ferguson particularly, when the Supreme Court will reexamine objective reasonableness?
I wish I could tell you yes, Kathleen, and that good law reform, a good Supreme Court case would change everything. That's how it happens in our courtroom dramas on TV and in the movies. I really don't see that happening, and I think that's kind of a dead end. I mean, advocacy groups and citizens can press for lawsuits, but the law is very clear, and I think that will be a very long-term goal to reach, to change. I'm a little more optimistic when it comes to political solutions that are less dependent on changing Supreme Court jurisprudence, but changing policing strategies, changing institutions in our police, bringing in independent prosecutors state by state to handle such police shooting cases, knowing that many such reforms will be superficial. I think in Wisconsin, the law that you have, Wisconsin Assembly Bill 409, really may not turn out to changing anything. At least that's my impression from the in-depth reporting I've read about the investigation into the police killing of Dontre Hamilton.
You checked evidently on this, and you would think that this would be a given. You asked the question, are there any civilian oversight systems at any major police department in the U.S.? Nobody you interviewed for the article, you say, could name one.
No, and in fact, many people told me that civilian oversight entities eventually get co-opted by the police and really bent to the will of the police, who tend to be wielding a lot more power and holding all the best cards when it comes to, you know, how power is wielded. So I'm not particularly optimistic about civilian complaint review boards. The one we have in New York is, I mean, even people from the New York chapter of the ACLU have told me that privately that they think it's pretty useless. It might be the beginning of something real someday, and it's good to have that institutional basis ready. But it's very weak. It exercises very little power. And complaints that do get verified by this review board don't even stay in a police officer's personnel file. Really, no one could come up with any other examples of successful civilian oversight. This is a real problem. I hope I don't need to remind anyone listening that the police work to serve society, not the other way around, and they have to be ruled over by us, the civilians, us, the citizens, not the other way around. When you have the police making all their own rules, that's called a police state.
What about, I'm wondering how many of these there are, Chase, you look at excessive force suits that have been settled out of court. It's interesting where the money is coming from for these settlements. Are there many such settlements?
there are settlements all the time in any big city and in plenty of small towns that have smaller sheriff's departments, too, where you have civil lawsuits against the police for excessive use of force and other abuses. And, you know, it's reasonable to assume that this must be changing police behavior. I mean, after all, getting sued for a lot of money tends to change the behavior of private citizens, of corporations, what have you. But in fact, when you look at these closer, these civil suits against police departments, where victory for the plaintiff is a lot easier to get than, you know, than in a criminal prosecution because it's a lower standard of proof, really don't change police behavior. And in large part because the money that pays out these settlements to people who have been mistreated by police does not come out of individual police department budgets. It just comes out of a city's general fund, a county's general fund. It's not like the police department is feeling the pinch. It's not like individual police officers are feeling any pinch. They're indemnified. There's a great study by Joanna Schwartz of the UCLA Law School that found that governments, not individual officers, are paying out 99.98% of all the damages. So this is, again, just kind of a dead end. And it's a good way to get some kind of compensation for people who have been wronged by their government, by their police department. So I think there's at least some good accomplished there, but it's not changing police behavior, and that's something that needs to happen.
As you were putting together the article and from studying the issue, have you found that there are certain cities in the country that are doing a fine job of policing, that they have a model that other cities should emulate?
I'm looking for models, and one model that's come up is Richmond, California. This is a very working-class municipality. Large non-white population in the East Bay. It's just north of Berkeley and of Oakland, California. But there's a very humanistic police chief there, came from Nebraska, I believe, of all places. And he has just found a way to make sure that the police do their job with a soft touch, that they're always trying to de-escalate and defuse potentially violent situations rather than ratchet them up. I'm afraid I found a lot more object lessons than role models, though, Kathleen. And Albuquerque is really leading the pack right now as one of the most violent police departments in the U.S. Puerto Rico, okay, is an American territory, has a notoriously bad police department, and there's been a lot written about that. Now, there's some improvement possible in these places when the Federal Department of Justice launches investigations and then takes some kind of control over entire police departments, whether big cities or counties or towns throughout the country. Right now, the Federal Department of Justice has 27 police departments under investigation, and these are often called consent decrees, where the DOJ will send in experts on new training, on new practices, and just do root and branch reform work to try to stop more police abuses happening. These efforts to reform police departments from the DOJ, they don't involve prosecuting individual cops, but they do have real effects in just changing deeply entrenched habits and practices. Mm-hmm. And there's some room for optimism there.
And Albuquerque is certainly one of those cities that is under Department of Justice review.
Yes, it is. Absolutely.
And how are the other cities decided? How do you get under Department of Justice review?
Well, they're fairly vigilant in Washington, and Obama's Civil Rights Department in the Department of Justice has done a pretty good job, I think, it has to be said. And other DOJ administrations have also done a good job. Los Angeles' police department is much improved after being under the tutelage of the Federal Department of Justice for a few years. And the Angelenos I know say that it's gotten much better. There's much less gratuitous use of deadly force, gratuitous use of force, and a new emphasis on civil peace and de-escalating. The feds almost took over wholesale the Oakland Police Department in 2012, but they were able to reach an agreement and just try to reform things there. So that's that's how you get under the radar of the Federal Department of Justice. Enough headlines, enough stories of people getting shot, beaten up for no reason by the police. And that's a problem that has to be solved. And the DOJ does a pretty good job much of the time.
Chase, we've heard so much, particularly with the Eric Garner case in New York City and also with Ferguson, about this model of policing, broken glass kind of policy, making sure that people aren't riding their bicycles on the sidewalks the wrong way or on the sidewalks if they shouldn't be on the sidewalks, that they're really targeting minor offenses. Is that policy widely in practice all over the country? And I'm wondering how that became a model. It seems as though you cite in your article, which is amazing, I think this is Ferguson, over 20% of city revenue, 20% of city revenue comes from municipal courts with just those kinds of offenses, mostly from people who don't have a lot of money to pay the fines.
Yeah, Kathleen, you see that kind of petty over-policing in many places throughout the country, but not everywhere. In Ferguson, what we have is the city government has been treating its people and people passing through Ferguson, you know, less like free citizens with individual rights and more like exploitable cash cows for revenue, like a human slush fund. And Ferguson just announced that they're going to try to make up their municipal budget deficit by issuing even more tickets and fines. This is really has to stop. This revenue collection by petty over-policing is just inexcusable. It often boils down to just criminalizing being working class, criminalizing being poor, and treating people like just exploitable milk cows for money. And that's one of the reasons why there was such a reaction in Ferguson to the killing of Michael Brown. I mean, that was just the thing that set it off, the tip of it, because people there were extremely fed up with this kind of treatment. And this kind of petty over-policing for small offenses, bicycling on a sidewalk or driving with an expired license or walking a dog the wrong way, you see it much more in working-class neighborhoods throughout the United States rather than in middle and upper class neighborhoods. Reason being, middle and upper class people wield more political power and they will push back and fight back and write letters and demand a new police chief if they're treated this way. But in working class communities and neighborhoods where people often have a whole host of other pressing problems and matters, this is less of a possible response. And that's why you've seen the explosion in Ferguson and why you see it there elsewhere. But we really need to get beyond this kind of police petty harassment and find a different way for, first of all, for cities to raise tax money and raise revenue, and second of all, to maintain social order other than criminalizing being working class, criminalizing poverty. That just makes for a toxic relationship between the government, between the people.
We're going to welcome phone calls. Chase Madar is our guest this hour. His piece, Why It's Impossible to Indict a Cop, appearing in The Nation on November 24. We have yet to talk about video recorders. There was a video, of course, of the Eric Garner case in New York, and people were appalled by what they saw. So why didn't that make a difference? Does it make a difference to have these kinds of recorders? We can talk about that. And welcome your comments on all that Chase has already said. Our phone number for you to join this conversation is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Email here is talk@wpr.org. You can always leave messages on our Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're on Twitter as well, and that's @KDunnShow. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Chase Madar is our guest this hour. He's a civil rights attorney and wrote a piece in The Nation that caught our attention on November 24, and that's what we are talking about. 800-486-8655 is our number, and let's start our calls with Greg in Stoughton. Hi, Greg.
Hello. I guess I see this as more a problem that's existed for quite a while. Naomi Klein wrote a book called Slack Doctrine. And in it, what she talked about is how politicians and corporations get together and they create what is a problem. it gets on the news, and the news creates it an even bigger problem, then they swoop in and fix it. The problem is they never really fix it because it was never really a problem in the first place, but they profit from it. Then they turn around and provide those profits to the politicians so they can run again. Just a few examples of what's going on. We had three strikes laws. We had crack cocaine laws that were stiffer on blacks than cocaine penalties were on white. We increased our prisons to the point where Tommy Thompson, our governor, guaranteed, in a free enterprise system, guaranteed them a certain amount of prisoners. This is systematically just the way we go about it. If you want to write the next story, write it about education, where they're doing the same thing.
Chase.
Yeah, thank you for that comment. I mean, there certainly is some entwining of the profit motive with the kind of over-policing we see. You have working-class people, for the most part, being forced to pay their own court fees, sometimes their own prison fees. You have the privatization of imprisonment, still a minority of prisons, but it's, an important minority. You have the privatization of probation services in many states. And all of these functions really cannot be left in the hands of private companies that, where the bottom line is really the only line, with very minimal public oversight, very minimal regulation. Criminal justice is one of these things that's just far too important and far too sensitive to be left to the profit motive. At the same time, I think it's a complex relationship between our steroidal law enforcement and mass incarceration state and capitalism. I don't think that making big bucks is the only thing driving it. The fact is we did have a long and steep increase in crime in this country, peaking in the early 90s, and that's part of what drove this massive expansion of the police state, this massive expansion of law enforcement. I don't think it was the right solution. I don't think it justifies the horrendous incarceration rates and steroidal law enforcement that we have, but it does explain it. And what's really the sad thing to me is just how political this is rather than economic. A lot of people, a lot of Americans are happy to pay with their tax dollars to punish people. There's a lust for punishment that's really crept in the DNA of our social policy across the board. And in a way, our supermax prisons are our cathedrals. They're how we spend our social surplus, the way European towns did in the Middle Ages and in the Renaissance, pouring that surplus into cathedrals. But we're pouring it very willingly into prisons and over-the-top law enforcement with just deadly results.
And do you see that, and a lot of those people are in for nonviolent offenses. There's a big move in Wisconsin to get our prison population more like the population in Minnesota, our neighboring state, which is much, much lower than it is here. Has there been a significant movement all over the country to examine, just because of the costs of putting people in prison now, nonviolent offenses being put elsewhere instead of in prison?
You know, the national mood has changed. I mean, and really across the board. And I want to tell you about that. But first, I want to sketch some context. It's true that there are a ton of people locked up for nonviolent offenses, but people often overestimate how big a share that is. It's really just 20 to 25% of our prisoners who are in for nonviolent drug offenses, and a little less than half who are in for nonviolent offenses at all. So it's a very sizable minority, and we should make policy changes that gets nonviolent offenders out of prison and in a good, better place as quickly as possible. That should be low-hanging fruit. I think there's a dawning realization now that mass incarceration in this country has reached a level that's just abominable. We have much lower crime than we've had since really the early 60s. A lot of people don't know that. If you're glued to your TV set and all you watch is CNN and Fox, you might think that we're in the middle of a nonstop crime wave because that makes TV news. But really, crime is lower than it has been for half a century. We need a peace dividend for that. I was at a conference at NYU Law School a few months ago, and I heard even several Republicans and conservatives there, among many Democrats, talk about the way we need to just empty our prisons and look for alternative ways to deal with, to reach social order rather than locking people up, looking for alternative ways to deal with our social and economic problems rather than throwing cops and prosecutors at them. I have a cover story right now in the new issue of the American Conservative magazine. This is founded by Pat Buchanan. You don't get more conservative than that, mm-hmm. which I interview and have a long conversation with the former conservative Republican Attorney General of Virginia, who used to be a real lock-em-up guy and favored and supported and pushed through all kinds of harsh-on-crime measures when he was in the state legislature. And now he has completely turned around, and he is going around trying to undo all those policies. He's a conservative Republican who's really seen the light. His name is Mark Early. This piece isn't available online yet, but if you look for it, it'll be online soon.
Kathy in Milton sends this email. Our local police department recently became accredited. Do accredited police departments have fewer cases of over-policing?
Well, I really don't know. I mean, accredited by whom and accredited in what way? I think it's really important to be a bit skeptical of accreditations and just to look at results and look what's going on. And I hope that this emailer, small town police department, is behaving in a humanistic way, genuinely concerned for security, and not acting like they're on steroids. But accredited, that can mean a lot of things.
Let's go to Daniel in Milwaukee next. Hello, Daniel.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I got to say, I agree with everything the guest is talking about as far as, you know, the over-regulation of minor offenses that never expire legally and just stack up year after year after year. I mean, I can tell you personally from as a working class guy who's just, you know, just a hair above, you know, receiving support from the state, you know, it is death by a thousand cuts. A parking ticket cost me half a day's wages. A jaywalking ticket cost me half a week's wages. And I understand that, but I do think you might be alienating some of your audience from your point when you try to connect that to the Mike Brown shooting, you know, and I think there's millions of people in this country who are examples of how this system has failed, who are nonviolent, you know, tax-paying, hardworking people with families. And those are the people who people should be championing and protesting for, not someone who's violent and was killed as a result of that.
All right. Well, thank you for your perspective. I'm never afraid of alienating people. I mean, I'm not coming to bring peace. I'm coming to bring my mouth and tell people what's what. So, the distinction, Michael Brown, I mean, he had just robbed cigars from a convenience store and he gave the clerk a shove. You know, the penalty for doing that should not be summary execution. The penalty for selling loose cigarettes in a park in Staten Island, New York, should not be summary execution. We have a real problem with police just going instantly ballistic. And, you know, even acts of violence, shoving a clerk, should not be dealt with summary executions. That is not law and order. That is another form of violent chaos. And I can't tell you how happy I am that even though things are bad in the United States, at least it's not Saudi Arabia, our treasured ally in the Persian Gulf, where, you know, petty offenses are met with summary execution and hanging. And I do not see that as a role model for my country. So, you know, the point to all of this isn't saying that, you know, there should be no policing at all. The point is that policing should be civilized, and it should not be reaching for the pistol at the slightest provocation. And police officers need to be able to deal with some violence without immediately reaching for a pistol. If you're a zero-risk kind of guy or gal who doesn't think you should suffer any risks at all, You should not be a police officer. And by the way, I'll point out that the job of being a police officer is a lot less dangerous than being a farmer, than being a roofer, than being a commercial fisherman, and a host of other things. You know, there's this weird adulation of police, seeing them all uniformly as heroes who are risking their lives. You know, occasionally you see that. There are a lot of great police officers out there, but there are a lot of really bad ones, and we shouldn't overstate the amount of risks that are faced by police officers.
Oh, I think police officers take a lot of risk. I think it's a very tough job. I mean, it really is. When you've got domestic violence things, you've still got a lot of violence in this society. There are a whole lot of people in this society who have guns, and you're dealing with that, and people who are, you know, killing each other in certain areas and drive-by shootings. And I think it's an understatement to say that it's not a risky job. It's not a hard job.
Well, yeah, it's frequently a hard job, frequently a thankless job. But the job requires dealing with violence in an appropriate way.
Right, I agree.
And that's where we're really not getting it right in this country. If you're unable to handle violence in an appropriate way, in a proportionate way, then you really don't have business being working in law enforcement. That's just how it is. And other countries can deal with this better than we do. We should learn from them. And there are good models, again, like Richmond, California, here in the United States. But we need to look at ways to de-escalate violence, acknowledging that, you know, even though the crime rate has gone down a great deal in this country, and it's as low as it's been right now for 50 years, we're still a lot more violent than most other developed countries.
Laverne in Green Bay. Hi, Laverne.
Thank you for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
My question is, you know, I have several friends who are police officers, ranging from local PD all the way up to a U.S. Marshal. So I understand that on occasion lethal force is necessary to be used, unfortunately. But with the advancements in technologies, I'm wondering why we don't see more use of non-lethal force, pepper bullets, rubber bullets, tasers, that kind of thing. And if it's because of cost, how do you weigh the cost of using those versus potentially taking a human life unnecessarily, and the cost of the pending investigation and litigation afterwards?
Yeah, okay, less lethal force. I mean, of course, police departments should be using less lethal force to the degree possible. I do want to point out, though, that tasers, for example, are not non-lethal weapons. The term of art that's used for them is less lethal weapons. And they can kill people, too. I mean, the human body is surprisingly delicate. Chokeholds can kill people, too, as we've seen. I think what we really need is more strategic thinking in our police departments to see how they can de-escalate situations and diffuse situations, whether in a domestic violence scenario or dealing with someone who's mentally ill. That's something that's been outsourced to our police officers over the past generation, and they're very often not trained for it. How do we diffuse those situations so you don't even need the taser, you don't need handcuffs, and can just talk people down? It seems to work okay in other countries. And again, that's not to say that there aren't some occasions when police are justified in shooting back if they are shot at. But we are just extremely permissive with the use of official state and police violence in this country, and that's something that really needs to be reined in.
Let's spend a little bit of time on video recorders. There was a recording, of course, of the chokehold that killed Eric Garner in New York, and once you saw that, almost everybody was appalled by what they saw. It was just, it was horrible to watch that. It was a horrible thing that happened. What good was a video recorder other than getting people to realize how horrible it was and march all over the country? Was there some, you have a video so that it can be reviewed by somebody, or it didn't seem to serve much of a purpose in finding justice in that case?
Yeah, in the end it didn't. And I think having these body cameras worn by police officers when they're on duty is a good thing, especially if there's the right policies to back them up. But I think think people are going to find that they're not a panacea. They're not a solution for everything. They're not going to suddenly bring about all by themselves new kinds of police discipline that we so badly need. In fact, very often they're just going to illustrate how permissive our laws are and how permissive our legal institutions are when it comes to police violence, how much leeway police have. I mean, if the guy who strangled Eric Garner to death, the police officer who did that, gets off without any charges, then, and that's all filmed on TV, that just shows that we need a lot more than just these body cameras. So I don't think they're useless entirely, but we need a lot more. There's no technological quick fix here. It's going to be about politics. It's going to be about new policing strategies.
Thanks very much, Laverne, for your call. Jess in Milwaukee, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Three real points. One, anybody who is a suspect in any crime who gets arrested should never feel that their life is in danger, period. There's no reason why anybody should lose their life in the custody of the cops. That's called due process. And we don't know if he's guilty. We don't know if he's innocent. He was just charged with something and arrested for due process. Once he's killed, he's not allowed his due process. Secondly, most Americans get in the situation they get in with cops because they don't know how to deal with cops. There's a website called flexyourrights.org that will teach people how to handle themselves in police encounters appropriately. Be firm in your knowing what your rights are and asserting them, but be respectful because of the position that they have, and yes, it can be dangerous at times. And thirdly, well, to be honest, I forgot the third point, but thank you for letting me share the first
two. thanks for the first two, Chase.
I thought that was two excellent points. I wish we could have heard the third, maybe another time. I do think that, yeah, it would be great if American citizens and non-citizens, too, for that matter, knew their rights inside and out, if we all had law degrees, if we all had law degrees, what a horrible country that would be, but knew how to deal with the police. But I do think the onus is really on the cops to treat people, you know, with some dignity, with some respect. And that's something that our police forces, many of them, really need to work a lot harder on. Not putting the onuses on everyone to be a civil libertarian who can quote the law inside and out, but the onus should be on the police to treat people with some courtesy and with some dignity.
Chad Madar is our guest this hour. He wrote a piece in The Nation, November 24, in which he looks at a number of issues concerning police and minority communities and police and the excessive use of force and where that comes from in terms of the law. And how to police the police, essentially, is what we are talking about, and welcoming your phone calls. Thanks, Jess, for your call. Our number, one line is open, is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email, talk@WPR.org. Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show. And we're on Twitter as well, @KDunnShow. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Let's go to Dan in Eau Claire next. Hello, Dan.
Hello.
Hi, Dan.
Hi. Thank you for having this subject on the air. Back in 1992, my younger brother was killed by the police, murdered. I think he was murdered, in my opinion. And back then, there was no cell phones and all that. And he happened to be an African-American police officer, and my brother was white. Not a big deal was made of it. We did have a peaceful march, and he was one of the most passive, non-aggressive people that I've ever known.
What happened?
He was unarmed, and this police officer was off duty. He got done, I think he was weighing narcotics or something, like an ungodly amount of hours in his shift. He was driving a white Audi. He had jeans and a T-shirt on, and he shot my brother. What I believe my brother was running. The driver was intoxicated, and like your guest said, that's not, you know, to be executed for. And there was forensic evidence that proved that his hands were on the back of the car. he said he had his badge out. At one point, he said he had his, both of his hands on his gun. So, I mean, I wasn't there, but I believe this cop just freaked out and shot him in the femoral artery, and he bled to death and in the back, you know, back of an alley.
What was your brother doing? I'm sorry, I didn't understand that.
He was a passenger in a car, and this officer said that the car swerved. So even though he's off duty, he decides, okay, I'm going to go and do something about this. And he's trying to pull him over, driving a white Audi. Somehow, my brother's friend did pull over.
I see.
Who was intoxicated at the time, which is, obviously, they broke the law. At some point, my brother got out of the car. His handprints were on the trunk of the car. And when we brought in our own whatever, and we had a civil case and all that. But it's almost like people just tend to think that he must have been doing something wrong. And so, you know, the cop had to do it. But the evidence showed that he was turning to run. He lived a few blocks away from there. And the cop who shot him was actually basically his neighbor.
Oh.
Not that far. They lived within 8 blocks of each other.
Mm. So you had demonstrations. Did you have, was there a review of what happened?
Yeah, of course. You know, the inquest, they're not going to side. They're really worried about money. I think that's the bottom line. Even one officer said something to one of my parents, I believe my father, and said, one day I'll be able to come out and say something about this. Well, that was 1992. So, I mean, I understand they have this brotherhood. They were watching each other's back out on the, you know, out on the street. And they're worried about repercussions from other officers. But when somebody does something wrong, let's just, like, fess up here and realize this is not the way to police our citizens.
Chase, what do you say?
Well, Dan, I'm sorry for your loss many years after the fact, and thank you for that powerful story. And I think you're absolutely right that, you know, police departments, they need solidarity with each other and cooperation, but when it becomes a mafia-like code of silence when someone does something wrong and refusing to fess up, as you say, that's really a problem. I mean, that's not what should be governing. I mean, police departments should be capable of recognizing their own mistakes and admitting them and then acting to change them, and not responding with a, you know, tight-lipped omerta code of silence like the mafia. So that's wrong. And
I'm wondering how this works. If his brother was running away from the police, how are most people who are police officers trained to deal with somebody like that? I mean, your first recourse wouldn't be to shoot to kill somebody who was running. They're not a threat to you if they're running away at that point, are they? Can't you shoot to get them to stop if they won't stop? I don't understand why the lethal use of force happens.
Well, it certainly shouldn't be the response that you're allowed to just open fire on someone fleeing. But again, the objectively reasonable standard in Tennessee versus Garner from 1985 permits a really, really wide leeway of options, including lethal force to police officers. That's hardwired into our law. And very often, extenuating circumstances, any impression of a threat to an officer or a threat to other people, if there's just the flimsiest belief that whoever is fleeing might pose a risk to others, then the law smiles on that and finds it generally to be pretty okay. And that's why you have surprising outcomes, like from the Eric Garner strangulation in New York, or, you know, recently in my hometown of Cleveland, Ohio, a 12-year-old Tamir Rice holding a pellet gun, getting shot dead. And those police officers, I expect, will not be indicted any more than the older guy walking around an Ohio Walmart with a BB gun that he had just taken off the shelves was shot dead without any indictment for the police officer.
Yeah. Well, I'm so sorry, Dan. That was to be, continues to be, but even more so some 20 years ago, horrendous for your family. Thank you very much for your call. Stephanie in Madison, hi.
Hi there. Great show. I have to say that even back in the days of the Old West, via listening to Gunsmoke, a lot of times Matt Dillon would simply shoot the guy in the hand, shoot the gun out of somebody's hand, or shoot, you know, they didn't shoot to kill. My point is really about the kind of people that can be attracted to law enforcement and screening and for personality traits, authoritarian personalities, getting the right kind of people in policing, people who aren't, you know, on power trips or trigger happy, or also kind of dealing with burnout. That could be another problem with this attitude, and that just basically those issues. And I think that there's a real issue around some people, and it can supersede race or background or anything. People who just, you know, don't you dare question me. They really, they're bullies in uniform sometimes.
Chase.
Yeah, I think that is often a problem. Well, I mean, police departments need to have better discipline and to weed out people who are just using their badge and their authority to make others miserable, for sure. And, you know, I believe in police unions just like I believe in teachers' unions. I don't think they're intrinsically evil, but they should be, both should be sufficiently realistic to let people go. I mean, I think it was a very good thing. Not nearly enough, but a good start that Chief Ed Flynn in Milwaukee did fire Milwaukee Police Department officer Chris Manny after he shot dead Dontre Hamilton in a situation that escalated, it looks like to me, clearly because of the actions of the police officer. So even though there isn't going to be, in my view, I doubt there's going to be any indictment of the police officer, and I bet that the internal inquiry in the police department will clear him. And I bet the state inquiry, too, will not be especially harsh. But I think firing Chris Manny was the right thing to do.
Yeah, and it was followed by a vote of no confidence on the part of the police union. So, you know, it's a difficult situation, right? You want to all be together on this, but that wasn't the case.
Yeah, that would be nice. But the police unions tend to be extremely resistant to even the mildest criticism, and or God knows, someone losing their job, much less getting indicted or even convicted.
Right.
I don't think that just firing individual bad cops is really going to be the solution at all. But I think it's one way. People prove in their actions that they're just unsuited for the serious amount of authority that having the badge and carrying a gun and having that kind of license endows you with. I mean, and I'll point out that the police officer who strangled the guy to death in Staten Island, Daniel Pantaleo, he had been sued 3 times before for excessive force, and yet that he was still on the New York Police Department. That's really a problem. One thing that people are talking about doing now is crowdsourcing a kind of police offender registry that's publicly accessible online, so people know who the bad cops are, the cops who have been sued many times before, who have complaints against them. I think that's a good thing. It's too bad it comes to that, but that's the situation we're faced with, and that's a good way that we can defend ourselves against arbitrary state power.
About a minute left. Carl in Madison, hi.
Yes, I think it's a fascinating conversation. I want to pick up on something the last caller mentioned and your guest has responded to, which is I think the larger culture in which the police are housed, you know, to aspire to be a police officer, if you're a British kid in 1930 and there's the neighborhood Bobby, or you watch Adam 12 and there are guys in cop cars, but they're wearing hats, but they look like ordinary people. But then if you want to aspire to be a police officer now and you're looking at soldiers, essentially, is what we saw during the riots in Ferguson and elsewhere. The culture in which the policing is going on has to be part of the equation. If you're going to have a violent Grand Theft Auto video game environment in which you're going to place people who are going to then try to uphold the real laws, I agree with everything the guest has said in terms of the over-violence of the police, but I think the society as a whole, our gun-toting society and our knee-jerk, me-first reactions to things are at least as much a part of the problem than the individual officers.
Thank you, Carl, very much for your call. And, Chase, we're out of time. Thank you so much for being with us.
Chase, thank you for talking with me.
Yeah, our pleasure. Chase Madar, his piece in the November 24 issue of The Nation. Thanks to Cynthia Schuster with production help from KP Whaley, and thanks to Scotty Myers for on-air production here in our studios in downtown Milwaukee.